Hey, everybody. Host Nora McInerney is back for season two of The Head Start, Embracing the Journey, a podcast from Ruby Studio and AbbVie. In each episode, Nora has a real conversation with real people living with chronic migraine to see how they took action to understand this disease. So jump into the conversation for season two, a show that creates a little more space for empathy and understanding in such a complicated world. There shouldn't be so much hesitation around asking questions and asking for help. So don't wait. Join The Head Start, Embracing the Journey, and learn a little bit more about life with chronic migraine. Hey, everybody. If you've been looking for love at first sight, it's closer than you think. It can be found at your local shelter. So this June 7th to June 9th, join the Pedigree Adoption Drive, and the Pedigree brand will reimburse your dog adoption fees nationwide. Pedigree knows that bringing a dog into your home not only opens their heart, it can open yours too. Visit pedigree.com/adoption-drive to learn more and see full terms and conditions. Hello, Atlanta and Georgia and surrounding states and heck, the world. We are doing our first ever live Christmas show.
Yeah.
In our hometown this December.
Ring, 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 ring. It is stuff you should know.
So what can people expect?
So, Chuck, they can expect all the gloriousness of all of our Christmas specials that we do every year, but live on stage and with spiked eggnog.
Yeah, we're just going to sit up on stage and play all those shows on a tape recorder.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be so like, great.
This one was great. Do you guys remember this? It'll be 10 times better than that because it's going to actually be an all-new show with us live on stage, one night only in Atlanta, GA.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty cool, everyone. And it is December 8th at the wonderful Center Stage Theater here in Atlanta, where I have seen various shows over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to be there now.
Yeah. We're going to be there. It's a very intimate, cool little theater, so we're looking forward to it. We're looking forward to seeing you. Go to SYSK Live for information and tickets, and let's get in the Christmas spirit. Oh, and on Thursday, August 9th, starting at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, there will be a password-protected pre-sale. You use the code HIPPIERob. And you will get your tickets that day, a day before they go on sale to the general public, which is Friday. So either get them Thursday, get them Friday. Either way, come see us in Atlanta for our one-time-only Christmas special.
That's right. They go on sale this Friday. So don't snooze or you will lose.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryant. And wait for it.
Mm-hmm.
There is first time ever guest producer Dylan.
First time?
First time. I confirmed it with him.
He's nodding.
He said we're the only show here that he hasn't guested as a producer on.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
So the ban has been lifted.
Finally.
I don't know if it was his ban or
it was his ban.
Oh, okay.
They finally wore him down. But, you know, he's the regular producer on Afropunk Solution Sessions.
Yes.
Which is a pretty awesome podcast.
It is.
Hosted by our pals Eve Jeffcoat.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't pronounce the S on Eve's, but it's Eve's.
Yeah.
I verified this. And Bridget Todd from Stuff Mom Never Told You.
Bridget's Todd.
Right.
She has an S as well.
Right. But they do, they kind of present like, you know, Afropunk, like the tour, the musical tour.
Oh, yeah.
The awesome musical tour. They have like a side thing called Solution Sessions, and it's kind of like TED Talks, but for significant things that get overlooked generally. So like race-centric stuff or reproductive rights or things like that.
Right.
And it's pretty awesome.
It's good.
And you can get it anywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look at that.
Well, we got to pay him somehow.
I was just going to slide him my half-warm sparkling water as payment. No?
I've got a cold one here.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
How do you get those?
Out of the fridge. Yeah. So, Chuck, before we get started, again, a couple other things. There are two episodes in here that I want to do separately, okay?
I bet you I can guess them.
Let's hear.
Civil Air Patrol?
No.
What?
Sure, but that wasn't one of them.
Oh, well, that was one of mine.
Okay, so there's three, and this is a meaty episode.
Jeez.
What's the other one, then?
I don't know.
Oh, you know it.
Scuba? Or we already did Scuba Cat.
We did. I forgot about him. Did you interview the guy who made Scuba Cat swim around?
Yeah, and it's funny. We often mention Jackhammers as our worst show ever. I forgot. It's Scuba Cat.
Is it? Did you go back and listen?
It's got to be the worst episode ever, right?
We'll have to have like a listening party.
That was like not even a thing.
We'll listen to Jackhammers and Scuba Cat. It was a thing. It was that one cat.
Yeah, and I guess we can just come out and say now that Discovery Channel made us do that. That's like kind of one of the only times we were steamrolled.
That's funny.
Otherwise, we have autonomy.
I don't know if that was being steamrolled as much as Rickrolled.
Well, now I don't even know what you're going to pick then.
All right, I'll tell you then. No more suspense for you.
Coast Guard.
No. I don't feel like you know me at all anymore.
I don't.
Search and Rescue Dogs.
Oh. They're really?
Dude, I looked at the article. It's at least as big as this one.
All right.
Robust. And they don't have a lot of overlap.
Okay.
It's not like doing recycling twice or anything like that. And the other one is Getting Lost.
Oh, well, that's a little esoteric.
Right. I didn't expect you to guess the Lost one. I thought you'd get Search and Rescue Dogs. But there's like a whole psychology to getting lost. And this is about finding people. I want to talk about getting lost sometime. And it's just too much to put onto this one. So it's going to be its own episode, okay?
Great.
All right.
And I'll earmark Civil Air Patrol because fellow network host colleague John Roderick of Omnibus was a member of the Civil Air Patrol.
Is he mayor yet?
No.
Because that'd be something if he were like known as the flying mayor of Seattle.
He'd love to be the flying mayor
of
Seattle.
But even still, member of the Civil Air Patrol, it's pretty interesting. So he flies.
Did. I don't know if he's current, but Roderick, he has a very interesting past. That'd be...
Well, he's an interesting dude.
It'd be kind of fun to do Civil Air Patrol and pick his brain.
Okay, let's do it.
His weird brain.
Yeah.
All right.
Flying brain.
So we have our two organic show plugs in.
Yeah.
No one noticed.
And check. So we're talking today about SAR, Search and Rescue.
I forgot I wrote this.
You did write it back in like a million years ago.
Yeah, that's when I was so excited to be the adventure writer.
You wrote a bunch of adventure stuff.
When I was named adventure writer. Mm-hmm. Here's the funny part of this story. I was named adventure writer. I was really excited. Then after a while of doing this stuff, before the podcast, I went into an unnamed boss.
I know this story.
And said like, hey, man, I really think that like I'm kind of wondering about the future here and where I could go and – if I could work my way up somehow to do things. And he very politely was like, I think this is kind of the deal. And like, there is not much of a future here beyond writing these articles.
Yep.
And then that same dude would change my life by tossing a podcast our way.
Yeah.
Isn't that funny how things work out?
It is hilarious.
No future here.
Right. I think he even put a cigarette out in front of you.
On my hand. Mm-hmm. It was really painful.
So,
but a reminder still.
But you wrote some good stuff. The survival stuff is good. We have more to dig through.
I appreciate it. I was nervous going into when I saw this was my article from back then. I was like, oh, man, this is going to stink. But it was actually a decent article.
It was. It was an expansive article, too. There's a lot of stuff to it.
Man.
Because there's a lot of stuff to search and rescue. There's a lot of different kinds of search and rescue, right?
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, you know. Now I feel like the sham is up because you already know all this stuff, so I can't tell you anything.
No.
I guess I'll tell you guys who are listening to the podcast. But there's a lot of different types of search and rescue, right? There's urban search and rescue, which happens after, say, like 9/11.
USAR?
Yep. Oh, I've also seen it USAR.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's a little mouthy.
It is. There's like marine or water rescue.
Sure.
Which is usually the one that kind of comes to mind when I think of like military rescue. But then there's like combat rescue.
Yeah.
Like the Scott O'Grady thing, which we'll touch on.
Sure.
And then there's like the normal search and rescue that I think a lot of people think of, which is somebody getting lost in the woods or the desert or something, and a bunch of sheriff's deputies kind of spread out and start looking for you.
Deputies and just people.
Yes. Did you know that before you researched this article that people like dedicate themselves to this, spend their own money to on training and equipment and things?
Yeah, the reason I know that is because my dad had a touch of this when he owned a Jeep years ago. And I've told stories about him going out on snowy days and using his tow winch to pull people out of ditches. So I was just aware of there being a general like thing with certain outdoors people. Where they like to get in there and volunteer, and if they hear someone's trapped in the woods near their house, they're out there.
Yeah,
like I knew they existed.
But there's like an actual like process you can go through and become a registered like searcher.
Yeah, and I think some of these people are just do-gooders, and some of them maybe were like, man, I never was able to become the wilderness firefighter that I wanted to be, or the paramedic maybe. And
so I'm going to get the state to force them to hang out with me while we search.
Yeah, like this is how I can live out that unfulfilled, I was about to say fantasy, but that demeans it, unfulfilled, you know, calling.
Desire. Yeah. Dream.
All of them.
And then there's the last group of people who are like, I want to see a dead body in the woods. And they start joining SAR.
Man, don't get teamed up with that guy.
It doesn't always, isn't that always the way though?
Sure.
It doesn't always work out is the thing. Sometimes search and rescue becomes search and recovery.
Yeah.
But, I mean, most of this applies to it as well because search and rescue typically starts out as, or search and recovery starts out as search and rescue.
Yeah.
Right? There's always, it's kind of neat. Like, if you think about it, there's really no better quick sketch of humanity than a group of people who've never met the person they're looking for, take their time and effort and put themselves in peril to go try to find somebody who's missing. And starts out on the hopes that they're still alive.
Yeah, and that a lot of times what we were talking about there is like the someone was hiking and got lost, and these people kind of regularly go out and do this.
Right.
But then the stuff that really gets me is like the missing child, where entire communities come together to form, you know, quarter mile long lines walking through a field, or the forest together.
Yeah,
that's the stuff that's just like, man, I can't even take it.
Yeah.
You know?
Way to bring it down, Chuck.
Hey, that's what I'm here for.
So, so let's start at the start. So if you wanted to be a, it's professional, right? If you're in the Coast Guard or in the military and you're trained for this, you're a professional search and rescue person, right?
Sure.
It's not like you have your regular duty and then on the side you get called out for SAR stuff.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think the Coast Guard, well, we'll have to find that out, actually. I don't think they're sitting around waiting on a rescue.
Yeah, the thing is, I saw that the Coast Guard rescues an average of 114 people a day.
So they're always just rescuing.
So I wonder if they have, like, they're just, yeah, that's what they do, is their search and rescue people are searching and rescuing all day, every day.
I don't know. I'm stymied right out of the gate. Nice work.
Sorry, man. But we'll start with the Coast Guard because they're actually the heart of search and rescue. They've been doing this for at least 50 years now.
Yeah. I mean, there's a school in Yorktown, Virginia, called the National SAR School, and it's operated by the Air Force and the Coast Guard, and their motto is really great. Always ready, comma, that others may live.
Yeah.
And I believe a couple of years ago, they celebrated their 50th anniversary as a school.
In 2016.
Yeah. Because when I wrote this, I believe it was the 40th anniversary.
Yeah, this
was the most recent.
This thing's so old. You were talking about a change that NOAA was undertaking in 2009 in future tense.
Right.
You're like, when 2009 comes around, if it does.
The gray beard hairs are really showing. So they have three simultaneous classes of students going on at this SAR school at all times. And their goal as a program is to save at least 93% of people and 85% of property that's at risk. Pretty good goal.
Yeah.
And to be ready to be there and ready, I believe within 2 hours total response time, and to be like ready to go within a half hour.
Right. So like the moment they're activated to the moment they show up on scene, 2 hours tops.
Pretty good.
Yeah, that's great. And then imagine like rescuing 95%, 90%, 93%. Let's split the difference. 93%.
At first it was 95 and they're like, meh, that's shooting a little high.
Yeah, exactly. But 90's not enough.
Yeah, and being, you know, going through the test and the physical and mental testing for this is tough.
Yeah, so when I was researching this initially, I was thinking like, oh, this is cool or whatever. But I've actually come to admire anybody who does this. Not just because they're out doing this, but there's a lot of things that they're doing that I can't. And now we've really entered that that thicket, which is like the rescue swimmers test. And so the whole thing starts out with 25 pull-ups, which right there, I'm done. I'll give you three tops.
maybe 15 chin-ups.
Aren't they the same thing? No. Or do you put, like, the chin on the bar in a chin-up? What's the difference?
Chin-ups are knuckles facing you. Pull-ups are knuckles facing out.
Gotcha.
So chin-up, pull-up. Pull-ups are harder.
Yeah, either way, maybe three.
Yeah.
Tops.
Because chin-ups, you can, you know, kick and swing yourself up.
Right.
But a pull-up, especially if you do the studly arms apart pull-up, like that number.
Yeah. No, mine are, like, right under my face.
Yeah.
So you got 25 of those, followed by a 100-yard obstacle course. I'm assuming it's a pretty rough obstacle course. I haven't seen pictures of it.
Yeah, and this is while you're carrying two 50-pound dumbbells.
Again, have you ever picked up a 50-pound dumbbell?
Just once.
That's not comfortable.
Never do it again.
And you especially don't want to do it while you're doing an obstacle course that's the size of a football field.
Right. So then you're timed. While you march 1 mile and you think, big deal. This is after you've already done these other things, though.
Right.
And you're carrying a 40-pound rescue litter, which is, it's called the Stokes basket, too. It's that caged stretcher that you see so often on the news.
And in The Perfect Storm.
I like that movie.
It's a great movie.
Yeah, I don't know about great, but
it was a good movie.
It was good enough.
You convinced me.
And then it's still not over because then you get into your rescue harness, you put on your fins and your snorkel, and you swim a third of a mile pulling a victim in one of these rescue litters.
You swim a third of a mile to the victim and then another third of a mile pulling
towing them.
And you got to do all that in 27 minutes.
And I think this is after, you know, it's not like they're like, all right, we'll go rest a few hours and then you'll do this next part.
Right, right. Plus, just they make you chug a cup of pancake batter at every stop.
And so that's just the swimming part. There's also the inland training, which you got to learn to climb rocks. You got to learn to rappel. There's a 180-pound dummy that they'll, like, tangle up in a tree 50, 60 feet in the air.
So go
gotta,
get it.
Yeah, you got to figure that out. Sometimes they have combo scenarios. Like, this dude's in the tree. This dude's in the water. Like, go figure it out.
And don't use rocks to get the one out of the tree.
No.
Doesn't count.
Never.
So that's the Coast Guard, and I think the Air Force go in for that same academy, or maybe all members of the military go to the Coast Guard one, I believe. Yes. So the if you're a military search and rescue person, you train at the Coast Guard Academy for it, right?
Right.
If you're just a normal everyday person and you want to do it, there are SAR schools around the country, but they're all private. There's no accreditation.
Right.
I think it's probably buyer beware in some of those cases, but I also got the impression that there's actual legitimate, like, SAR schools. It's not just somebody who's like, thanks for the money, chump.
Buyer beware as opposed to full guaranteed or your money back?
Right. You will find your first person or all your tuition is reimbursed.
And then some of these folks ride horses. It's called mounted SAR, and horsies, even though it's an age-old way of getting around, are really valuable in search and rescue for quite a few reasons.
Yeah.
Like, first of all, they're horses, so they can go farther than your dumb human meat body.
Sure. Plus, they're nice to have around as well.
They're nice to have around.
And they can get you to places where you could kind of walk, but you probably shouldn't be walking. A horse might be a little more sure-footed, or a donkey.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I like how you said if you've been sitting in the lab analyzing stuff for the last few years, you might benefit from riding a horse out to a search and rescue location.
Yeah, I mean, that's a movie scene waiting to happen if it hasn't already.
It is, Wayne Knight.
Yeah.
Just griping, all mad that he's being dragged out into the woods.
Right, but and then they put him on the horse.
He's backwards on the horse. Somebody stop this thing.
The other thing you can do, obviously, the horse is a lot stronger than a person. So if you need a rescue leader towed up the side of, or, you know, pulled up the side of a cliff, you can attach it to a horse.
And then you're going to tell them about the radio thing? I never thought of this.
It's good. Go ahead.
So you can station horses in position along a route when you get further and further into the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And if you keep a radio transmitter on each one, it acts as like a radio relay network.
Yeah, just install a Bluetooth into a horse's ear, 10 horse's ears, and you've got comms.
Yep.
Not bad.
It isn't bad at all.
I feel like we should take a break.
Okay.
All right, let's do that, and we'll talk about Urban Tsar right after this.
Hey, everybody, we're here to tell you about Viator, a tool that you can use to plan and book travel experiences around the world.
That's right. The Viator app and website make it easy to explore 300,000 plus travel experiences so you can discover what's out there no matter where you're traveling or what you're interested in.
Yep, Viator can help you plan better travel experiences. 300,000 plus travel experiences to choose from means you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy.
That's right. You can also enjoy real traveler reviews to get insider information from people who've already been on the experience that you're considering. Plus, you get free cancellation that helps you plan for the unexpected.
Yeah, and Viator offers 24/7 customer service, so you know you'll get support at any hour if things aren't going as planned. So download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find the perfect travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator. Hey, everyone. Host Nora McInerney is back for season two of The Head Start, Embracing the Journey, a podcast from Ruby Studio and AbbVie. In each episode, Nora has real conversations with real people living with chronic migraine to see how they take action to understand the disease.
That's right. Recognizing how a migraine attack can change the course of your day, she unpacks each guest's journey and how they talk to their doctors to find the treatment plans that are right for them.
Yep. Along with headache specialist Dr. Christopher Ryan and other special guests, Nora speaks to these incredible people who've channeled their feelings of isolation in their chronic migraine journey into advocacy and art. Plus, there are also 8 episodes of their first season available for you to binge.
So jump into the conversation for season 2, a show that creates a little more space for empathy and understanding in such a complicated world. There shouldn't be so much hesitation around asking questions and asking for help. So don't wait. Join The Head Start, Embracing the Journey, as they learn a little bit more about life with chronic migraine.
All right, ma'am. So we're talking about USAR or USANDAR.
Yes.
Depending on who you're talking to. This is a whole different type of fish, kettle of fish. When you're talking about urban SAR, it's not woods. It's not like cliffs. It's not the ocean. It is enormous skyscrapers that have crumbled in on themselves. And you're sure that there are people trapped inside. And you have to figure out how to get into this rubble and get them out without getting killed yourself.
Yeah, and this is a division of FEMA. Probably should come as no surprise. And I believe in 1991 is when they set this up, the National Response Plan for Disasters. And they have 25 national USAR task forces. Mm-hmm. And in the case of a flood or earthquake, what else, hurricane, plane crash, hazmat spills,
tornadoes, any natural disaster.
Yeah.
A terrorist attack.
Sure.
I think they were all called out for the Oklahoma City bombing.
Yeah.
Definitely 9/11. Katrina, they were integral. And some of the bigger ones that you can list off, basically every single one of these task forces was called in to assist.
Yeah, and assist is the key word there because they are supporting local and state emergency systems who generally take the lead in these cases.
Yeah.
31 people, I think, per team for a USAR task force.
Mm-hmm.
And how many did they deployed 20 of these on 9/11, like right out of the gate.
Yeah, I think all of them except for Virginia was activated, and Virginia's was at the Pentagon instead.
Oh, sure.
But like the rest of them were in New York for 9/11. It was just, I was reading a firsthand account from a SAR team member at 9/11, and they were just like, it was just utter chaos. Like the people who were in charge were all dead when the second tower collapsed.
Yeah.
There was just like he said there was just a total leadership vacuum that got filled pretty quickly, but he said, I've never seen anything like this before. It was nuts. But the way that they had to improvise was pretty astounding.
Oh, yeah. And there's all sort of secondary dangers, you know, after a building like that collapses.
Right.
I guess we can talk about it a little bit, but, I mean, everything from hazardous materials leaking to, you know, electricity, downed electricity that could, you know, shock and kill you,
mm-hmm.
to water mains bursting and, you know, filling up spaces and drowning people.
Right.
It's like they're every single front you can imagine they're attacking.
So one of the first things they do, every search and rescue situation or every disaster is actually operated initially by the local cops.
Yeah.
That's who runs search and rescue. And like you said, FEMA's there to assist, and usually the state agencies are there to assist too. But one of the first things that happens when FEMA's USAR teams come on the scene is they have like structural engineers who are licensed professional engineers,
yeah.
who have experience in construction or inspection or something like that, who come in and say, they look at this. So once this was a nice, tidy structure,
mm-hmm.
now it's a different kind of structure.
Right.
And it's not tidy at all,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of hidden dangers. But their job is to come in and assess the structure of the rubble and figure out how to create safe passage into this thing. And it's pretty amazing that they can do it at all.
Yeah, and you mentioned the dogs, so we won't get too heavy into that. But I believe the largest deployment of dogs in history was for 9/11.
Yeah, I think 80 at least.
Yeah, search and rescue dogs. It worked 12 hours at a time.
All right, that's enough about search and rescue dogs.
And I value them. Can I say that?
Sure.
Okay.
That's no big news.
No, take it back.
So one of the ways you want to talk about what they do when they come into these structures and figure out what to do?
Sure.
I didn't know this. I guess I'd never thought about what they would do, but there are Kevlar bags that you can put underneath up to 70-ton pieces of, like, concrete or metal or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and inflate them, and it will actually lift them up to, like, almost 2 feet off of the ground.
It's pretty amazing.
And then once you have that, you start to shore it up. You put in steel beams and then or wood, depending on how heavy whatever you're lifting is, and you actually start to create basically, like, an old-timey, like minor 49er mine shaft into this place.
Yeah.
Just shoring up and lifting and shoring up and along the way to stabilize the structure. And then once you have entry into this place, then you start sending in different kinds of rescuers. So you've got like the medics who go in.
Sure.
You have people who send in cameras or mm-hmm. listening devices to try to find survivors. You got the people who are testing the air quality to make sure that the air conditions or the conditions of the air aren't like deadly.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine this is all like you're on the clock too. So like you have to make sure it's safe to go in there,
mm-hmm.
so you're just not killing people that are going in to rescue.
Right.
But at the same time, you're trying to get people out of there. You're not just like, well, let me go investigate the scene and what's going on down there.
Right.
So, like, you're on a timer, but you have to make sure it's done safely, too. It's just like, I can't imagine how overwhelming that must be
yeah.
as a rescue effort leader.
Yeah, because there are people who are running this whole show. There are logistics people. There are
yeah.
people who are overseeing everybody and making sure that this whole chaotic scene is running smoothly.
Man.
I can't imagine a more stressful job, especially having that clock ticking on lives just draining away, just hanging over your head. That's just nuts that people do this.
Yeah, and you like you said, you've got hazmat specialists there. You might have to suit up yourself before you go in. You might have heard on your listening device or from a camera that some people are trapped like 100 feet into a place you can't even get. So
mm-hmm.
you send them like breathing tubes.
Right.
Or you might send a rescue litter down there and say, if you can get in this thing
mm-hmm.
and strap yourself in, we may be able to pull you out.
Do you?
Because we can't get in.
Do you? Right. But at the same time, you have like heavy equipment operators running like cranes and bulldozers trying to like
yeah.
pick off the pieces that the structural engineers have said, like, you can get rid of that one. And they'll
yeah.
like lift them up and move them and try to remove as much stuff as they can. But yeah, all this, the clock is ticking. Do you remember the I think it was the Bay Bridge collapse in San Francisco during the World Series in, I think, 1989.
The earthquake?
Yeah. Uh-huh. It just so happened San Francisco was playing Oakland in the World Series, and that earthquake happened. And do you remember, like, the top deck just fell down onto the other deck?
Oh, yeah.
On top of people in their cars, and, like, some people survived.
It's amazing there are people out there that, like, I would just start crying in place. And huddle in a corner. But there are people out there that can stay calm enough and are experienced enough to just be like, all right, well, this is what we do.
Right.
Starting right now.
Yes.
Man.
Yeah. Those are the people who slap people like you and me and tell us to snap out of it. Like Cher. Cher's one of those people.
And maybe some of those people think, can you imagine sitting there and talking about our job?
Right.
And explaining what we do. How perilous that is for these two.
That's right. I got a paper cut earlier. Oh, I wasn't going to say anything about it.
It was rough.
To help prove your point.
We should shout out the Civil Air Patrol, though, even though I do want to do a show on that.
Sure.
They are a nonprofit with more than, I don't know what the numbers are now, but when I wrote this, there were more than 55,000 civilian pilots and cadets.
Mm-hmm.
And they, since 1941, have supplemented our own military's aviation. It's pretty neat. And like Roderick he was pretty young when he did this too. I guess he was a cadet.
I gotcha.
That'd be my guess.
I'll bet he had the most polished shoes you've ever seen.
I'll have to ask him about it because I've never actually spoken with him at length about it.
Yeah. I think it's civilians, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And it was originally supposed to be like, we're the liaison between the Air Force and the rest of civilian America.
Yeah.
But then they said, hey, we think there's some Nazi submarines off the coast of Maine. Can you start dropping bombs, too? And they said, giddy up.
Oh, I'm sure they were delighted.
Yeah. They started dropping bombs and depth charges in World War II, and things were never the same after that.
Yeah. So, Civil Air Patrol, your day is coming.
Okay. Sorry, I just gave a little more information.
Oh, that's right.
Do you want to go back and edit that out?
No.
All right. So, we talked a little bit about some of the equipment USAR carries with them.
Yeah.
But it's impressive. And again, if you were a mayor and your local sheriff or your local police chief or the police commissioner called you and said, we had a building collapse and we need some help, you call the governor and the governor says, we'll see what we can do, but we think this is a federal thing. They call the president and the president says, FEMA, get in there. And FEMA comes free of charge with tractor trailers full of supplies.
Yeah.
From what I saw, it's about just one task force's equipment is like a $1.4 million package.
Amazing.
Of 16,400 pieces of equipment. Everything from like medical supplies to generators to the bulldozers to everything. And they just show up and say, how can we help? You're in charge. How can we help?
Yeah. And it's almost like, all the mundane things of assembling, it's like assembling a film shoot or something. You're like, well, these people have to eat.
Mm-hmm.
They have to go to the bathroom.
Right.
Like all
they need to sleep.
Yeah, they need to sleep. They need to rest. So you have to set up like a little a village, like in the case of a 9/11, or any major disaster like that. It's pretty astounding. Like the one, I imagine this list grows daily because the one thing you don't want to ever happen is to be on the scene of a natural disaster and be like, give me the thing. And you're like, oh, you didn't pack that thing.
Why not? Yeah. Well, I like 16,400. It's a nice round number.
But like you said, everything from like chainsaws and jackhammers to like bolt cutters and porta potties.
Yep. Which we did an episode on.
We did.
We'll probably do one on bolt cutters one day 20 years from now.
We did one on jackhammers.
We did.
Should we talk about Acer?
Yeah.
Aaron C.
Yeah. So this is where the extraordinarily trained rescue swimmers and divers come into play.
Yeah, this is amazing. I think it's the stat I got in here was it has a 50% dropout rate.
Yeah, look,
to go to the school.
There's like higher, you know, like,
depending on the year.
No, I mean there's other military schools that have higher washout rates, but not many.
Yeah.
It's mostly special forces. I think the Ranger School typically has about the same washout rate as the rescue diver school or rescue swimmer school. It's substantial. Like you, there's a really good chance you're not going to make it. Actually, a 50% chance you're not going to make it.
The Coast Guard says that, and this is pretty interesting, 95% of all sea rescues are less than 20 miles from shore, and 90% of these are only rescue. Thankfully, because of all of our distress beacons that we're armed with these days, like you can usually, well, 90% of the time, you can find these people pretty quickly, at least.
Yeah, and the Coast Guard, and I don't remember exactly when it was, but they updated the distress system that they had since the 70s, where you called in on a radio frequency and said, "Mayday, mayday," and tried to give your position. Mm-hmm. Maybe you had a beacon that was operating on that frequency that they could try to track.
Yeah.
They updated all that with something called Rescue 21, as in the 21st century. That's way more sophisticated than it was before. And so now they still monitor that channel for voice maydays. Mm-hmm. But if you press your beacon, it enters this vast computer and communications network that the Coast Guard maintains in at least a 20-mile area outside of all of America's shores.
Yeah.
And you're going to get their attention pretty quick.
Yeah, and these beacons now, they operate at 406 megahertz. That's the newer standard.
Oh, no, they will as of 2009.
Yeah, one day. Man, I was a young man when I wrote this. Mm-hmm. Jeez.
Just a little pup.
These things are manually activated a lot of times, but they can also be automatically activated. So, like, if it hits water, like, not if you spill water on it, but if it's submerged in water, like the boat is sinking,
right,
it'll automatically activate. Or, and this is cool, it's if it goes above a certain G-force.
Right.
Then that means bad things have happened.
So don't take it on a roller coaster.
No.
One thing I saw about that Rescue 21 is one of the updates that they made to it was it has geolocating now, so they can tell where a distress call is actually coming from.
Yeah, like it's satellite pinpointed, right?
Right. But that actually does away with the prank calls of yesteryear. People would actually prank call distress calls into the Coast Guard.
That's so expensive.
And now they can be like, we can see you're calling from Nevada. You're not out in the Pacific Ocean right now, you jerk.
Wow.
Isn't that terrible? Can you imagine leading the Coast Guard in a wild goose chase? What kind of jerk would you have to be? Or are you like some sort of unstable search and rescue guy who's like, let's get out there.
It's like the arsonists who are also firefighters. Very interesting.
I thought so, too. And then one more thing about the distress beacons. There's a new – so the weather satellites that NOAA operates, NASA has onboard instrumentation that they have a SAR office themselves. NASA does. And their whole thing is basically tracking human beings through their beacons, hopefully just through their beacons and not through, like, I don't know, their cell phones. Mm-hmm. But now if you press your beacon, it immediately goes up and immediately gets shot out to the rest of the – there's actually a global search and rescue network. So wherever you are in the world, that distress signal will be spread out.
Right.
And then in the meantime, as they're getting their resources together, they can start to try to find where you are. But they you get their attention almost instantaneously now, thanks to NASA.
Wow.
Yeah, and then eventually the beacons will be that instantaneous and also give out your coordinates down to something like 100 meters.
I thought you were going to say eventually it will predict your disaster.
No, eventually
before it happens.
It'll just shoot a tractor beam down onto you.
Oh, man.
Pull you up to the satellite and it'll land you at Edwards Air Force Base and serve you a nice hot meal.
Wow.
And then send you on your way.
That'd be great.
That's the future.
All right, so Combat SAR is next, and I don't know. I don't think about this stuff a lot cuz I generally just think of the military is like, well, they just do everything.
I thought that Gene Hackman assembled like ragtag groups of people to go in behind enemy lines like 10 years later. I thought that's how we did it.
What was that?
Uncommon Valor.
Oh, that's right.
Maybe one of the best post-Vietnam movies of all time.
I don't know about that. Have you seen it lately?
I saw it within the last probably 5 years.
Really?
Yeah, dude, it's good.
All right.
That I'm not a gun guy, but when that guy... gives Gene Hackman the menu of the heavy artillery and guns.
I remember that when I was a kid, thinking that was the coolest thing ever.
It's still pretty cool when you see it today.
I was like, I would take that one and that one.
Yeah.
It's so funny. Like, I think, I don't know, we're not gun guys at all, yet the notion of a gun menu just lights us up. What is that all about?
There's some part of our brain.
It's just brainwashing from movies.
Yeah.
Probably.
I guess.
You know?
Sure.
That's my guess. All right, so CSAR, they're basically kind of the first people to arrive behind enemy lines in the course of battle. And the U.S. Air Force takes lead in this situation. So anytime there's like a Scott O'Grady situation where someone has, let's say, ejected from their jet behind enemy lines.
Dude, on fire.
Yeah, well, that's the worst case scenario probably. Mm-hmm. That is when CSAR really earns their medal.
Yeah.
You know?
And you, I mean, the story of Scott O'Grady kind of says it all, right?
Earns their medal? Tests their medal? To eventually earn a medal?
Sure.
Is that what I meant?
Yeah.
I'm mixing metaphors.
I think you got it all together, though.
Yeah.
So I think the Air Force still is tasked with combat search and rescue.
Correct.
But they're starting to do it jointly with the Army, I think, as well. But they have what are called expeditionary rescue squadrons. That is the name of the people that you want coming after you.
An ERS?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they go in, like you said, behind enemy lines under a tremendous amount of danger. There's usually two helicopters. One goes in and actually airlifts the person out. The other helicopter is there to
shoot
at people. Yeah, and be like, stay back. Because this is again, it's behind enemy lines. One of your pilots has been shot down. One of you guys has gotten lost or captured or something. These are the people who go in and get them.
Yeah, they have planes too. Long range search planes like the HC-130, which can actually refuel these helicopters, the HH-60s, which they said the planes are when there was not much of a threat. Then I think the helicopters they use up to a medium threat. But like you said, they have, ground support going on too.
Yeah, and there was a real push to update their helicopter that they use to one that's specifically designed for CSAR.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the plug got pulled on it.
Oh, really?
So they're still, I think, working with the HH-60s? I'll bet they call them double H-60s.
That's even longer.
Okay.
This is kind of the cool part for me for CSAR is – you don't really think about this, but if someone has been shot down and they do have radio comms ability and they can get in touch with you,
mm-hmm.
you need to be able to authenticate this signal, whether it's a beacon or a real human voice on the other end, because they could be compromised. They could be sitting there with a Kalashnikov to their head.
Yeah.
And being forced to lure someone into a trap of a foreign enemy.
Right.
So you have to be able to authenticate these calls, and they do that by never giving their full details over the radio as it stands. They'll say to add numbers or subtract mm-hmm. or multiply digits in your call signs and your rank and your unit numbers and stuff like that.
Right, and then they verify who you are. And then once they verify who you are, they'll come get you. But there are some conditions are more ideal than others. And when Scott O'Grady very famously went down in Bosnia during the Balkan War, I think in 1995, they received his distress signal finally, I think 6 days on.
Yeah.
He'd been surviving by drinking the sweat out of his own socks and eating bugs and spending the whole time evading getting captured.
Yeah.
Did just an amazing job of staying alive and staying uncaptured. But he sent out his beacon, or they received his beacon or distress signal a couple hours before dawn. And they're like, this guy's already been missing for 6 days. We found him. We can't let him just stay for another 6 days because the ideal conditions are after dark.
Yeah.
They couldn't do that. So 2 hours after that, they went in after him, in broad daylight, I guess.
And wasn't it Marines that actually got him out?
Sure.
And what was it? Wasn't it 20 minutes or something ridiculous?
Two.
Oh, 2 minutes.
Yes.
From the time they arrived to the extraction.
Yeah. To the time they were gone again.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
That's
I'm sure he wasn't lollygagging. I'm sure he was let's go.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, wait, I forgot my basket I was making with reeds. I got to go back and get it.
Pretty amazing.
So I saw about his story. I looked up what happened with him. He released a book called Return with Honor. And, you know, they made that movie Behind Enemy Lines with Owen Wilson and Gene Hackman again.
Oh, was Gene Hackman in that?
He was like the guy who was trying to get Owen Wilson out.
I never saw that movie.
He sued Fox, 20th Century Fox, and then eventually Discovery Channel.
He sued over casting?
He sued, he sued for basically appropriating his life story. And the problem that he publicly said he had with it was that Owen Wilson used foul language,
yep,
was portrayed as a hot dog pilot, and disobeyed orders. And that Scott O'Grady was none of those.
Now, was he actually Scott O'Grady in the movie, or did they thinly disguise it?
Thinly disguised, which meant they didn't need to pay him any royalties.
Right. And it also probably meant he lost his lawsuit, I imagine, right?
I don't know. I didn't see that. I just saw like a 2001 Entertainment Weekly article on it.
Well, the definitive source.
It's good journalism, man.
All right. Well, let's take a break. And we'll talk about some search techniques and other fun stuff right after this.
Hey, everyone. Host Nora McInerney is back for season 2 of The Head Start. Embracing the Journey, a podcast from Ruby Studio and AbbVie. In each episode, Nora has real conversations with real people living with chronic migraine to see how they take action to understand the disease.
That's right. Recognizing how a migraine attack can change the course of your day, she unpacks each guest's journey and how they talk to their doctors to find the treatment plans that are right for them.
Yep. Along with headache specialist Dr. Christopher Ryan and other special guests, Nora speaks to these incredible people who've channeled their feelings of isolation in their chronic migraine journey into advocacy and art. Plus, there are also 8 episodes of their first season available for you to binge.
So jump into the conversation for season 2, a show that creates a little more space for empathy and understanding in such a complicated world. There shouldn't be so much hesitation around asking questions and asking for help. So don't wait. Join The Head Start, Embracing the Journey, as they learn a little bit more about life with chronic migraine.
When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and free.
That's right. On LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Hire professionals like professionals on LinkedIn.
Yeah. LinkedIn knows that small businesses are wearing so many hats that they don't have the time or resources to hire. So LinkedIn is constantly finding ways to make the process easier. They even just launched a feature that helps you write job descriptions, making the process even easier and quicker. LinkedIn does all that while making the process easy and intuitive. No wonder 2.5 million small businesses use LinkedIn for hiring.
So post your job for free at linkedin.com/SYSK23. That's linkedin.com/SYSK23 to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
All right. Now, this feels like a no-brainer, but it's actually a little more interesting than you would think, establishing your search area.
Yeah, so let's say...
Where do you look?
Now we've moved on to somebody, say, like lost in the woods is a really good example of this, right?
Yes.
It happens a lot.
Yes.
And there's like, if you're a sheriff's deputy, you may or may not have any SAR training. If you're the sheriff, you may or may not have any SAR training.
Yeah.
That's probably unlikely these days, but it's a possibility. But even if you're the only one in your department... You've got a whole department who you need to explain what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing you have to do is start looking for answers to your questions. But you need to know what questions you have to ask first. So you're looking for any kind of evidence specifically of where the last place the person was seen was. That's the first thing you want to find.
Oh, yeah, last seen or I think last seen can also be last well, that's not true because last known position is different. So if someone was last seen leaving a trailhead, for their hike. Let's mm-hmm. say they were last seen at noon,
right?
Starting at this trailhead.
That means that another human being who's now talking to you as an eyewitness said, "I saw this person."
Yeah, like maybe they either saw someone on the trail or they checked into a ranger station mm-hmm. and got their backcountry permit or something. They're like, "I'm off. So long, suckers."
Right.
That is different though than last known position. So if someone is missing, their last known last seen place may be the trailhead. But 3 miles in, if they find that person's baseball cap, then mm-hmm. that is their all of a sudden their last known position. If you compare that to where they started, you might be able to reasonably come up with maybe they're headed in this direction and they might be somewhere in this area by now.
That would be an enormous break, because if you can figure out when they were last seen, like you were saying, and then when this thing was found, you know the direction and roughly the speed that they're going.
Yeah, and there are a lot of assumptions involved here.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully hopefully someone wasn't like, they dropped their baseball hat and then decided to go in a completely different direction.
They did. They closed their eyes and twirled around and just headed out.
Yeah, so that's how that works. But generally, it's a circle unless you...
Starting from the place they were last laid eyes on, right?
Yeah, because they could theoretically be going in any position, right. In any direction.
Right, right.
Unless you come up with something called a choke point, which is kind of interesting. That is where you have either a man-made feature or some sort of geological natural feature
mm-hmm.
that cuts off an area. Like
they're not
they definitely, couldn't have climbed that 300-foot cliff.
Sure.
So now we can go in this direction.
Or cross that crazy river.
Yeah.
And... say if it's a river, if it's a cliff, you can just position somebody at that cliff and be like, stay here in case you see them.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a river, you can say, well, they would have, if they wanted to cross, they'd have to go to this bridge. So stay here on this bridge in case they come this way. That's one thing to do when you have a choke point, right?
Yeah. So if you have a searcher named Cliff
right.
and a searcher named River.
Yes.
To avoid confusion.
And if Jeff Bridges is searching as well, or Bo Bridges, either one.
To avoid, I think we know that Jeff would be doing the searching, right?
I don't know. I think Bo's
Bo would just
helpful.
Be telling him how to do it.
Maybe. He is the bossy older brother, right?
Man, those guys are the best. Like, they're.
Have you met Bo?
I've never met either one of them, but I've just heard interviews with both, and they're like brothers should be.
Oh, you've heard interviews with them together?
No, separately, talking about each other.
That is so sweet.
It is very sweet. They're like best buds.
That's cool.
And very big brother, little brother.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's kind of neat.
I wonder what the Quaids are like.
Oh, man. I'm curious about that because Randy is, you know.
Yeah, I know.
He's developed into something else.
He has. So, So if you were searching from the last...
Known position?
No, not the last known position.
Last place seen?
Yes, the last place seen.
Yeah.
So that's where you start. Mm-hmm. If you're searching from that and you start heading out and you find that baseball cap, mm-hmm. that is a huge clue, like I said.
Sure.
And probably the people who found it are what are called the hasty search team.
Right.
Because right when you establish a last place seen, you send some people out who are usually like... very experienced, very well-trained SAR people.
Mm-hmm.
And they start scrambling out in every direction in that circle.
Lightfoots.
Looking for, that's part of it. They probably climb a tree like nothing.
Yeah.
Going to the places where it would be most likely that somebody like this would go to.
Yeah, and that's when they think like, you know, this person's in danger. There's a storm coming in or night is falling and it's going to get really cold.
Mm-hmm.
You deploy these hasty search teams. They're not out there combing the ground for clues.
No, but I think it is a matter of course that the first thing you do is deploy the hasty team,
sure.
And then you follow up with the deliberate people.
Yeah, the clue team. That's what we'll call them.
All right. Colonel Mustard.
They go a little slower, and they are – and I think this – I mean, well, I guess it kind of depends. It could be for someone just trapped in the woods, but definitely they use these for those community searches when,
right.
like – a kid is missing or something.
Yeah.
These are the things you see on the news when people are walking very slowly through the woods because a clue could be a cigarette butt on the ground,
mm-hmm.
you know?
And you have people, say, spaced 20 feet apart.
Yeah.
And each one is responsible for everything ahead of them and 10 feet to the side and 10 feet to the other side. And then that way, if everybody's doing what they're supposed to be doing, every square inch of this search area is covered eventually by these searchers, the second group of searchers.
Yeah, they'll also use track traps sometime. So they'll like maybe go to a trail, a place on a trail or any place really, and they will put like sand on the ground, and then they can go back and check that sand. If there were footprints, they know that it wasn't their footprints, so that might be a last known position, perhaps.
So, Chuck, if you get lost,
yes,
and they find you, and they say, "Hey, come back with us," you might say, "No, I'll find my own way back. I'll crawl back myself, even though my leg's broken." Why would a human being do that?
Well, because you might get a bill at the end of the day or week or month.
Yeah, depending on what state you get lost in.
Yeah, this is a lightning rod in the outdoor community because there's a lot of facets to this. One facet is, hey, if you did something dumb and you went somewhere where you weren't supposed to go and you weren't equipped to do this or experienced enough to do this, why should a taxpayer have to foot your $60,000 bill of rescue?
Right. It's a legitimate point. So they say pass laws in some states to deter people from doing something stupid.
Sure.
On the other hand, the other side says search and rescue is a pure public service.
Mm-hmm.
Just like you don't get a bill from the fire department. If you do this kind of thing, then people will think twice about calling for help. If they don't have the money and they know they're going to get a $60,000 bill,
yeah,
they might actually just put it off too long. And then by the time they say, okay, fine, I need some help, it's too late and they're going to die out there.
Yeah.
You don't want anybody thinking about money during a search and rescue operation.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a weird balance you're trying to strike between encouraging people to get out and explore the wilderness, but only wanting people that are to go in certain places and that have a certain experience level.
Right.
To do so, and to certainly not like the worst case scenario, like you were talking about, is I'm in trouble, but I'm not going to send out my beacon.
So apparently the Colorado Search and Rescue Board actually put together 15 cases. This is according to Outside Magazine of people who actually delayed calling for help
to EW.
because they. They knew that they would be charged,
yeah.
Or there was a chance that they would be charged. Like so it actually happens. It's not hypothetical. Like
right.
It happens in real life. So there are some states, like New Hampshire, apparently is the last place you want to have a search undertaken for you because they actually do bill.
Yeah,
they've done something like $70,000 in billing for like 60 rescues since 2008.
Those are pretty low cost rescues.
Yeah, it's surprising.
Like this one guy in this article, is search and rescue a public service? Not exactly, is the name of the article. And there was a man named Ed Beacon who had an artificial hip, went hiking by himself on a bad weather day, tried to jump onto a ledge and dislocated that artificial hip, and took it all the way to the state Supreme Court when he didn't want to pay his $9,300 bill.
Yeah.
And the state Supreme Court said, sorry.
Yeah, because New Hampshire has... In their law, it says you can be billed if you are shown to have been negligent. And the state Supreme Court agreed with the case against him that said he had a replacement hip, so a faulty hip, and he knew that there was a large possibility of bad weather.
They said, stay home, old man.
Basically.
what are you doing?
Yeah, but he fought it up to the Supreme Court and lost. And after that, you got no recourse.
Yeah, and there's... There are quite a few states that have laws like this on the books that range from very specific to very broad. And just because your state has this on the books, a lot of times it's to dissuade people from being dumb.
Right.
It doesn't mean you're going to get hit with a bill, even if they have the law on the books. It's up to them whether or not they want to pursue that.
Right.
And then a lot of states have programs that you can pay anywhere from $3 to $25 to – basically say if you've paid this money, that means that you don't get charged for rescue.
Right. It's like a communal pot that everybody pays into
yeah.
with the chances of them actually needing it very slim. But
right.
if they do need it, then they've got it.
Yeah.
Which I think is a great idea.
Not bad. I think any outdoor enthusiast that regularly does this would throw in $3.
Sure.
Or $25.
Sure.
You know?
Yep. For a year.
Per year.
Yeah, that's not bad at all.
Yeah, and the federal government apparently does not Although that could always change. You never know. They don't get reimbursed.
But they have a policy of not charging.
Yeah.
Last thing I saw, there was an app. You know, I'm crazy for apps like Gluco for diabetes. There's also an app called DroneSAR. And it basically takes over your drone and flies your drone in a search pattern for a search and rescue mission.
So this is if you're a drone pilot who is lost.
No. If you have one of those
what did I miss?
Rotor, multi-rotor drones that you like to fly around and buzz your neighbor's roof with.
Yeah, so you're a drone pilot.
If you show up to a search and rescue mission.
Okay, gotcha.
Say, I got a drone. You want to use it?
Uh-huh.
It's got a video camera on it. They say, sure, download DroneSAR, and the DroneSAR app will take over your drone and fly it as part of this search.
Gotcha.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, shout out to my buddy Lowell. Mm-hmm. My sister-in-law's boyfriend is a drone pilot. A couple of shout outs for Lowell. He's a drone pilot and a good one.
Sure.
Because I've seen him in action. And, you know, it's not the easiest thing in the world to do. He doesn't.
I would imagine not.
He doesn't crash these things. Although it is kind of funny to see drone fails on YouTube.
Right.
Because it's always going great until, like.
Until it's not.
There was one I saw today where there was some sort of ape or monkey preserve, and they were flying all around. It's like, man, this is gorgeous. Look at all these apes and monkeys doing their thing. And then it flies up close to one, and this monkey just fully takes a stick and goes whack.
Oh yeah.
And then the next thing you know, you see it falling on the ground, and then, you know, all these monkeys start descending upon it and like poking it and stuff.
It's awesome.
It's pretty neat. So shout out to Lowell for that. And I meant to say a few weeks ago, I finally vaped with Lowell.
What?
And gave it a try. I was like, you know what? He's a vapor. We got a lot of flack for dissing vapors.
Yeah.
And I was like, all right, let me try it. And it was one of those, you know, flavored things.
With no nicotine?
No, it had nicotine.
Okay, at least you're smoking nicotine.
Yeah, and it was, I will say this, it was interesting.
So are you hooked on vaping now? Are you
a vapor? No. I never did it again. I took a couple of puffs. It's like, well, that's interesting. It was like banana.
Okay.
And I was like, I didn't know quite how to wrap my head around still, like, the pleasure of inhaling vapey banana.
You're like, but the funny thing is, I can't stop thinking about it.
It was weird. I was like, I mean, it wasn't like, oh, this is disgusting.
Right.
But I didn't want to do it again either.
That's good, Charles. I think that is the lesson here.
I just thought I'd give it a shot, so.
Well, good for you for trying new things.
Yeah.
Don't ever do that again.
Yeah. Lowell's leading me down a bad path.
You got anything else?
Nope.
So we got a whole sweet coming. Just wait, everybody. I can't wait. And in the meantime, you can look up Chuck's awesome article, SAR, Search and Rescue, on How Stuff Works in the search bar. Since I said search bar, it's time for listener mail.
I'm going to call this Golf Pro. Golf Pro.
Okay.
Hey, guys. Like many in the golf business, my first job included time as a picker as a teenager. And, of course, I soon became acquainted with the multiple bangs and clangs of Titleist ricocheting off every side of the cage. Remember we talked about taking aim on the driving range at those Volkswagen Beetles. A few years later, when I was beginning my career as an assistant pro, I found myself supervising these kids, one of whom relished his time on the range, and especially the chance to engage in good-natured trash talk whenever his cart came within reach. On one such occasion, after a friend and I had missed him on several point-blank attempts, he turned the cart away from us to make another pass on the far end of the range, confident that our aim would certainly not be better as he moved further away. Traveling in a direct line away from me, he had reached a distance of about 150 yards when my laser beam 3-iron shot took flight on a low trajectory and never left its target. It came as a surprise to him and to me when instead of the usual clang followed by laughter, we heard a dull thud and a low groan. It turned out our range picker, which is the car, included a narrow gap of about 2.5 inches where the back of the cage met the top of the seat and the rear of the cart. Despite my countless hours in that old machine, I never noticed, and neither had he. Thankfully, his likable demeanor had led him to be well-tipped by the membership, and the wallet in his back pocket, thick with dozens of dollar bills, took the brunt of the blow. I don't see how that would have happened, but if he was sitting on his wallet? How'd it hit him in the butt?
Maybe it was a tiny, maybe he has a big butt. I don't know.
I don't know either.
Sir Mix-a-Lot would love this guy.
So Brian says, as I have never made a hole in one, this still stands as my best shot I've ever hit.
Oh, yeah. That's better than a hole in one.
And one might argue that it's even more difficult.
Yes.
And that is Brian. He is a golf pro.
Thanks, Brian.
In Northern Cali. And he said to both of us, if we're ever out in Carmel,
okay,
and we want to, A, play golf,
all right,
with a golf pro.
Yes.
We could do that.
Okay.
Or if we want to actually drive the picker, he would let us do that.
I'd just rather play golf.
I want to do both.
Okay, well, shoot.
let's do it.
Let's do it. Thanks a lot, Brian. That was also an excellent, well-written email, if you ask me.
It's great. Brian Sleeman, he's the head pro at the Preserve Golf Club.
It's basically a John Cheever short story.
Agreed.
Maybe Updike. I don't know. One of the two.
Yeah.
If you want to get in touch with me and Chuck and offer us something awesome like Brian did, you can go on to our website, stuffyoushouldknow.com, find all of the links to our social medias and catch our attention that way, or you can just go straight to the horse's mouth and send us an email to stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Hey, everybody, if you've been looking for love at first sight, it's closer than you think. It can be found at your local shelter. So this June 7th to June 9th, join the Pedigree Adoption Drive, and the Pedigree brand will reimburse your dog adoption fees nationwide. Pedigree knows that bringing a dog into your home not only opens their heart, it can open yours too. Visit pedigree.com/adoption-drive to learn more and see full terms and conditions.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.